from you guys. And, you know, if you want to discuss it, that's great. And if you don't want to discuss it, that's okay, too. Anyway, I thank you for this particular little, I thought at once it was going to be sort of short, but it went about an hour, which is okay. So we'll move on to the next segment, which is questions, topics, comments, and what have you. Wes already put down his name. And if anyone out there has any questions or comments or topics that they would like to discuss tonight, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name, your call sign, and you know what kind of stuff you have for us tonight. You don't have to tell us the subject. You just kind of, is it amateur radio related? Is it non-amateur radio related? Stuff like that.
AD2DU.
B2BX, sir.
AD2DU, Alex and Frank recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight? Okay, maybe a little bit later some people will show up. We gave you an hour to show up late, so I don't think, you know, showing up late is an excuse anymore. But, Alex, what's your question or topic for tonight?
I can't find my LifePO, like, trickle charger for my 100 amp hour LifePO battery. All I have is this little, what looks like a laptop charger that ends in a barrel connector for the smaller LifePO batteries. Is there any way I could use my desktop power supply from my radio to do like an Anderson power pole connection to the car battery size LifePO to charge it? I use the LifePO, the big one in the car, to power the VHF UHF radio without being connected to the car battery. AD2DU.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I used to kind of remember, charging devices are different for different technologies. You would not want to use a lead acid charger for a lithium iron phosphate charger. I don't know if there's that much nuance between lithium iron phosphate charging technologies and lithium ion charging technologies. My guess would be not much, but I would suggest you Google it. You know, there are current chargers, there are voltage chargers, you know, so you wouldn't kind of want to use something completely different, like lead acid would kind of eventually ruin your lithium iron phosphates over time because its method is optimized for lead acid. But I don't recall exactly if lithium ion and lithium iron phosphates are close enough that you can kind of use them interchangeably. Probably a good Google search would kind of indicate that.
Do you have a charging device you recommend for all your lithium iron phosphate stuff?
Well, when I bought the lithium iron phosphates, I bought them with chargers. And in addition, I have something called a, power gate. I have a power gate that is a lot of people who are, you know, good at designing their own small circuit boards have built their own. But basically, it switches emergency power from the battery in, and it charges the battery when it detects that the voltage has dropped beyond a lower version. So those are the charging technologies that I use. A lot of times, I'll just cycle my lithium iron phosphate batteries on my power gate. Because, you know, as long as the power supply is running, you can disconnect the battery. The whole idea is if the power supply from utilities fails, it shifts it over to the lithium iron phosphate as the power source. But that's what I use. I use a power gate, and I use the company that manufactured or at least sold in the United States my lithium iron phosphate batteries when I bought them.
it. Well, thank you for the info. I think I'm just going to buy a second one because clearly I would like to have a little redundancy here to charge all the house batteries. AD2 to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good idea. If possible, you know, if it doesn't cost too much, I would probably get a beefier charger so that down the road if you get any lithium iron phosphate batteries with higher capacities, they'll benefit from that higher power output capability. But, you know, it's always good. Redundancy is a good thing. I have more than a few things redundant. Sometimes it turns out to be a waste of money when I buy something and I figure that there's a particular part that's going to wear out eventually. I'll buy an extra one. It's not too expensive. You know, sometimes a completely different system fails and I end up not being able to retrieve it and I end up with an extra spare part that I can't really use. But ultimately, I think it's always good to have things on hand. Like with my laptop, I almost always burn out my fan. The bearings always go, and it sounds like a 747 running in the room with the laptop. And so I always tend to, in one of my drawers, have a spare fan assembly for them. And I've used those emergency fan assemblies more than a few times. So, again, I would agree with your idea.
Would a bench power supply be useful for recharging anything where I could toggle the voltage and the polarity or whatever?
Well, I mean, if it needs a good charge, at first, possibly. So the problem is, what do you do as you approach a reasonably full charge? If you use something like a voltage-controlled a charger, where we keep the voltages stable and let the current go anywhere, that's great for acid cells, not great for lithium ion phosphates. I think that they tend to prefer a current stable power source. So the problem with a generic power supply is that, you know, most power supplies don't have a fixed current output. They have a fixed voltage. So it would be sort of the same thing as charging up your lead acid, using a lead acid cell charger. But if you're stuck with a battery that's kind of almost dead and you need to get it up to 50, 60, 70% you can get away with it. But if you're using it to kind of trickle charge to maximum, that's when different types of power supplies might be problematic.
Understood. Well, thank you for the info. I'll send it back to that. 82 to you.
You're welcome, Alex. So, Frank, long time no talk. How you doing? What can I do for you tonight? Frank, I see you here on Echolink, so I know you have a connection. Maybe you stepped away to do something. So I'll ask if you're out there. This is AC2GS. Are you out there, WB2BXO?
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Dolphins here.
Okay, good to have you here. You have a question tonight, or you just wanted to point out that you're here?
I do have a question. I'm wondering about getting a second transceiver. I have an Icon 7200 for a dipole in the house. And I really think you should give advice, whether or not you recommend doing it or not.
Okay, Sam, unfortunately, you're about 70-80% noise. Is there any way at all you could kind of get into the repeater a little bit better? I don't know exactly what your options are. If you could kick up the output signal or you know, tweak something, because I hear, you know, about every third word. But unfortunately, I think I need to know, hear every word.
Okay, Roy, I moved into a different part of the room. This is better. Alpha Echo 2, Yankee
Alpha. Yeah, it's a bit better, Sam. I can hear almost every word. There's still a little bit, you know, it's about 50% noise, 60% noise. But at least it's 40% voice, so it's much better. Try to talk more loudly into the microphone. Maybe that'll help a little bit, too.
WKDU, thing that I learned studying for the exam is that you speak louder and it generates more power. WKDU, how's my transmission? I have my ICOM 7300 to a dipole on the roof of the house on the third floor, and I want to get a cheap transceiver to use with a whip antenna in the backyard on the first floor. And I was looking for some advice as to what I should consider. I would like to do all bands like my ICOM. Thank you. Professor Einstein, how's my copy, Professor Einstein?
You're doubling with Sam, A2YG. You realize that?
WB2BXO is back.
Okay, Frank, I picked up with Sam, AE2YG. When we finish with him, I'll get back to you, okay?
Yeah, that's fine. I had some other things going on the computer. I couldn't clear quickly enough. Anyway, go ahead with Sam, WB2BXO.
Okay, gentlemen. So, what I'm going to do is save this question for the Kings County Radio Club meeting on February 5th. I'll catch you at 7 o'clock, and I'll present my question to you at that time. Anyway, I'll be listening, and have a good evening.
Okay, very well, Sam. I'll see you then. Thank you. Thank you for participating tonight. So, Frank, what's your question for tonight?
Okay, a couple first ham radio related. Wanted to know how you did on 10 meters today. I worked the guy who's regularly on there, the guy in Namibia, using an old school tail end to sneak in there. Anyway, so that should add a new country for me on 10 meters. Also, I'm about 5 miles from the plane crash site. The plane took off from the runway literally across the street from me. I'm not sure if you guys already, I tuned in late, so I'm not sure if you've already discussed the plane crashes yet. Go ahead.
No, we haven't. We were pretty much discussing AI tonight.
Okay, yeah, I tuned in at the end there. I remember, I think you were talking about Eliza. I remember playing with that on my first computer when I was a kid and trying to make it crazy. that was kind of fun, but I like your analysis of what Eliza actually did. And I remember there were some people in the 60s writing papers about her who actually took her kind of seriously when it was just a fun demo. Somebody did just for fun at a psychologist convention, I think. And as we say today, it kind of went viral. Anyway, yeah, with, you know, regard to the plane crash, the jet rescue crash. As I said, we're very lucky here. The plane took off from runway across the street here, northeast Philadelphia Airport, known to aviators as Papa November Echo, or PNE. I might have heard of taking off, and it may have registered in my mind. That's a lot of noise for a small jet, but I guess we did not hear the explosion. I do know the explosion knocked a door off, one of those heavy doors off a diner, off its hinges at a diner 6 blocks from the crash site. I just heard they picked up the CVR. I haven't heard where it was found. I'll have to catch up with that info later. Anyway, if any of our aviators are on here, I'd wonder if they have any thoughts on that disaster yet. So go ahead.
Okay, Frank, call to arms. Any of our air pilots out there who would like to give us an explanation as best they could about so far what the general public knows about this unfortunate accident. Anyone's out there, please hit that push to talk.
Does it have to be a pilot? WV2EAV.
Well, in my heart, you're a pilot, and it's a pleasure to talk to you again. It's been far too long. I hope you are well.
Short answer, much, much better. There was a reason why I disappeared for a while, but I'm doing much better now. I've been trying to get back here. Anyway, you're talking about the Washington, D.C. crash on Thursday, right?
Frank was talking about the Pennsylvania crash.
Well, I've heard about the Pennsylvania crash. As the plane took off, it had directions that while climbing, make a right turn to a different heading. And the ADS-B data showed that at one point, while still climbing, the plane started to drift left. And then it continued to drift left while climbing. And then all of a sudden it started descending. And then the descent accelerated and became an absolute dive. And nobody can really figure that one out. My theory is they were flying in clouds. It was nighttime, I think, but they were in clouds. They had no spatial orientation. They depended upon the instrument. My point is, it sounds to me like they had a catastrophic failure of the instrument, and they had no idea of the aircraft's attitude, and was just blundering along, and it got worse and worse.
Oh, that's a shame. I mean, how often, though, does that happen? I would assume that pilots check all that equipment on a regular basis, that they don't just kind of put it into standby and when they need it, just turn it on and such. So, I mean, is there any reason to assume it was a pilot error or just a mechanical error that's just bad luck type of thing going on?
Well, you never can really tell, but instruments do fail, and usually it's partial, and you have enough that you can work with, but there have been problems. As a general rule, if you're flying a plane, and you have to see the horizon, if you can't see the real horizon, there's what's called an artificial horizon or an attitude indicator. If you don't have either, you're going to die. Pure and simple. An interesting related case. About 10 years ago, a small plane was flying at night in bad weather up towards Connecticut from South Jersey or something. And as the plane approached the south shore of Long Island, the pilot reported a partial loss of instruments. Now, in that weather, you absolutely live and die by the instruments. And the instrument controller said, we're right into Republic Airport. You're coming about to go right over Republic Airport. We'll bring you right in. And he said, no, no, no. I got enough of this stuff working. I can make it all mine. He got as far as Syosset High School and ended up in Air Force Field.
Coming.
Yes, Wesley?
Of course, I'm not a pilot. Just logical thing. There was a mom with a kid who was treated in the hospital, and she had enough money to fly the jet into that city, and then after the treatment, out of that city, and there was one paramedic, one doctor, she, her kid, and two pilots. And all of them had to be paid. And all of them were in a national, Mexican national. None of them was American. So we may speculate what was the reason. Back to you, Dr. Wright.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're just kind of rolling our wheels at this point. Ed, is it likely that if it was instrument failure, wouldn't that be reflected in the black box when they finally get to take a good look at it?
Yes, the problem is, what I heard is they're not sure if that plane even has black boxes. Apparently it's a fairly old jet. And when it was built, they weren't required. And as of last night, I believe it was, no one was sure if it was ever put in.
That's unfortunate. I thought there were strict laws even for old planes that they would have to be retrofitted, but I guess not. Frank, you mentioned that you thought that you heard that they found the black box?
WS2N.
Yeah, Paul?
Yes, they reported
that plane had a voice box. They don't have a data box in that particular plane. So that's what they need. They're looking for that. They told everybody to go look for it. If you see an orange thing laying around, let them know. Call 911. Because it could be anywhere. I thought the thing would have, you know, a transmitter, you know, where they could pick it up with a beacon. But I guess not. Back to you, Roy.
Wait a minute. Are you talking about the transponder?
There's two different types of boxes. And like a big jet, you know, like the one that crashed in D.C. has both. And the medical Learjet only had the one.
Yeah, there's two types of black boxes, and the data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. And either one of them is very, very useful. However, remember, the way the plane hit the ground, that was a tremendous crash. It was hitting almost vertically down at a very high speed. So if anything will bust up a cockpit voice recorder, that would.
AC2GS. Well, you know, I don't know. It's terrible, these planes falling out of the sky. I hope something can be done to kind of stabilize the situation. I don't know if it's just a serial case of really bad luck or there's something strange going on, but we'll have to follow it. And I thank you, Ed, as always, for your expertise. I realize you're not a pilot, but you're the father of a pilot, and you know a heck of a lot about airplanes. So I thank you for your sharing your knowledge with us.
Well, remember, I designed a lot of aircraft that traffic and solar flip.
Yeah, I remember you telling us. Yeah, so, you know, at the very least, you're an honorary pilot, and you know your stuff. Again, I thank you for sharing your stuff.
I have told pilots. I would probably lie and say I was a pilot and get away with it, unless they really fooled me. But no one's ever called my bluff to try this.
Comment.
Yes, comment away.
This is KDTUAH, Roy. There's Rocco. I follow a couple of guys on YouTube. One is an F-15 pilot, retired, who had some good observations about it, and he runs a site called Pilot Debrief. He's very, very thorough, very accurate, and these were his observations. So basically, it was felt that one theory is that the plane might have stalled. And the reason that a plane might have stalled is because there was on the video a little dipping of the left wing, which lost lift and caused the plane to descend at about 11,000 feet a minute when it impacted. But because it wasn't that high off the ground, remember, we're talking only about less than 1,000 feet off the ground, the plane was doing, according to the ATC data, about only 245 knots. It was not doing 400 knots like people were saying, number one. Number two, there could have been errors when the pre-flight thing was done, that the spoilers could have been retracted, which caused the plane to lose lift on takeoff. Because other than a catastrophic failure of both engines, they would not have had such a deep dive. They would have gone into a glide mode like you saw at the Hudson, although the Hudson was much higher. At a shallower attitude, they would not have the ability to recover, but they would not have nosedived into the ground unless the plane lost lift and went into a flat spin or went into a vertical spin where it could go at 11,000 feet a minute in descent. But because it wasn't that high, the numbers that people are throwing around about 400 knots when it hit the ground is absurd. Back to the next.
Another comment,
Yes, Wes?
When the plane was coming back after the medical procedure, so there was no rush, there was no distress, there was no reason for the pilot to be under the pressure, I assume. I'm not sure if it's true, but there were some information that the black marks could have been removed from the plane. The plane didn't have a black mark at the time of the crash, but I'm not sure.
I have a comment.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
About the comments of the storm. That's what I thought until talk about YouTube channel. Blanco Lirio is the one who told me that the ADS-B data pretty much precludes that option because it was pretty smooth for a fair amount of time. It was more than high enough that you didn't have to worry about the impossible turn. Usually what happens is when an engine fails on takeoff or shortly after, be it a single engine or a double engine plane, sometimes the pilot will try to make an aggressive turn to come back and they don't realize a compromised airplane, if you start making turns that are too steep, you're thrown into a slow and crash. And it happens with annoying regularity in general aviation. That's what I thought it was. What I saw was the ADS-B data was showing the plane was smoothly climbing, even after it went off course. And it was a while later that it started to descend. So I'm not sure that adds up. Now, the ADS-B data is publicly available. You know, it's what the plane was telling ground control automatically. And it can be looked up, although I have not personally looked up the detailed data. Roy, WB-380.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ed. Hopefully, as time goes on, this is not going to be like those wacky drone sightings that were probably delusions. These are the real thing. So hopefully, as time goes on, we'll have a much better idea of what the possibilities definitively might be. And we can discuss it again as we learn more about it. And again, I thank you, Ed. And I thank you, as always, Frank, for bringing up an interesting topic for our little technical net here.
No problem. Yeah, the reports are plane climbed to about 1,500 feet, apparently. They were only in the air before something went wrong, about 30 seconds into the flight. Pilot debrief, I hit a wrong button on my phone and didn't hear the whole thing. He did on it this evening. Says he thinks it could have been a stall. He knows a heck of a lot more about it than I do. Disorientation, I would think is unlikely given how quickly it happened. But I don't know. There was, I think, a witness report that it looked like there was a fire before the plane descended. That would be really weird. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happened. And the explosion was huge, which is probably explained by the fact that they were fully loaded for flight to Missouri. Anyway, an interesting situation. I'm just that airport is, it would have been quite a challenge for him to glide back to the airport if he simply lost an engine, considering that that runway is surrounded by buildings, including the one I live in. It's obviously that airport's been there for many years before this became a built-in up area, I think. Anyway, thanks. Very interesting. The WB2BX stuff.
One more last point before I have to run.
Sure, Ed.
They're not high enough for air traffic control to hand them off to the en route center. That doesn't happen at very low altitudes. I mean, it was low, but not very, very low. By the time they were told to pull the en route center, that would be a couple of thousand feet of elevation. All right, with that, I have to run. WB-380.
Okay, thanks again for your help and your expertise. I look forward to our future conversations.
Thanks, Roy. Hopefully it'll be a little shorter this time.
Okay. I guess that's it for Frank's question. Anyone with any closing comments before we move on? Okay, very well. And on to you, Wesley.
Okay, I'm going to try to be quick because this is 9:35, 36 actually. Okay, Wolf SDR transceiver. So, in Russian made open project commercialized, there is a radio that looks quite quite interesting, and for some people quite fantastic. It has a 7-inch monitor with the waterfall, and is a full SDR transceiver, and my attention was concentrated on the price. That was $77.10, and it was 100 watts and all HF from 1.8 megahertz up to 440. And then I found another price, which is $99.91, and it was okay. That's not a big deal. But then I found on eBay $1,182.99 for the same. And it looks like really very well made radio. In China, of course, we have a tariffs, we have a sanctions. There is no way for us to buy something from Russia. But because the project was commercialized, Chinese took off, and they made that transceiver. Let me drop. Okay, so then today I spoke to Ukraine, to some ham radio operators. They explained me that $77.10 is only for the front panel. So if you want to have a front panel with the handles, with all of the buttons, with the liquid screen, crystal 7-inch, then you pay $77 or $99.91. But if you want to have a more radio, then it's going to cost you at least $800 whatsoever. So what this radio gives you? DDC, DUC technologies, it says 0 to 750 megahertz. Full mode reception, but actually it's from 10 kilohertz to 750 megahertz. It's just how the Chinese put it. The most powerful FPGA 3D spectrum and waterfall chart, yes, that is true. The large 7-inch capacitive touch screen enables multi-point touch. I'm reading support display in sunlight, built-in CW decoding, so you don't have to really be good in... anodized and Wi-Fi with a no tuner yet. So for $1,182.99, you're buying this with no tuner yet. But I found another price about $1,800, which has everything 100 watts and added 1.2 gigahertz into it. So it's all modes, all bands, everything, and sounds too good to be true. I sent you some pictures of that one that is in the case, and another picture that shows the back of it, which has a two PL connectors. One is for HF, the other one is for a VHF, UHF, I assume. I'm not sure, well, yeah, that's how it looks like. And we've built in radiator and a fan for it. So I'm not really convinced if we should spend the money for something that doesn't have a warranty, but I would like to have a second opinion of Dr. Roy Would it be rather better to spend money on 7760 that costs $6,500, but at least you know that you've got the Rolls Royce, I mean the Rolls Royce, Ferrari. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
Yeah, AC2GS, by the way. It's a Russian roulette thing. Just because people publish pictures and specs doesn't mean that they're real. A lot of times, fully accredited companies kind of screw things up, and their products don't meet anywhere near their specs. But in this case, you could just as easily get a Chinese package and undo it, and it's a brick. And, you know, who are you going to go to? Who are you going to complain to? Really no one. I mean, when I buy stuff in China, I try to buy it through places like Amazon, where I got at least an even chance of getting my money back. I bought a couple of things like cables recently that were being shipped in from China. And I kind of knew that there was something terrible about it. After a few days, it kind of got stuck at the very beginning of the tracking number and didn't kind of advance at all for 2 weeks. So, but, you know, again, I did it through Amazon, so I found another Chinese importer through Amazon, and I ordered it, and I got it a couple of days ago. And just today, I got a nice little email from the first company saying, we don't know what to tell you, but the shipping screwed up. Would you like a refund? And I said, yes. So, you know, the problem is, you know, for something that's $25, you know, no one's going to go crazy and try and rob me blind for $25. But for $1,000, they might. So I wouldn't take the chance, personally. I mean, again, it has no real reputation to speak of. It has no warranty. There's no way to repair it if it breaks. It just has way too many flaws and too... To me, it's just risky. I would rather spend more money on a well-known brand with an infrastructure for warranty and repair and replacement and what have you, you know, than to just do a Russian roulette. Because eventually, you play Russian roulette enough, you end up with a bullet in your head.
Interesting. I agree with that. So... North Action did stop commercialization from Russia as China represents Russian products. Now, when I spoke to the Ukrainians from Ukraine today, there was a whole discussion. There was one guy who bought the PCB board from China just to assemble it by itself, and he said that it cost him already $500 to have all of the stuff for it. And he already made the receiving part. He was astonished with the quality and compared it to ICOM, to the Yesu and other radios that he had. And I was like, wow. Okay. But if you can recall another radio that was very popular and had a 5 stars by Iham, that was discovered up 599TX500, that was 10 watts, up to 15 megahertz portable HF transceiver, all mode, with single sideband CW, DIG, AM, and FM. And I thought that this radio is no longer sold because of the sanction, because of the war, and because... of the restrictions whatsoever. No, it is being sold by HRO right now. You can buy it if you want to, even though that there are restrictions. I assume that this is because they buy it from China, and China is not restricted with it. So we close one door, they find another, they open another, and they're making us fools. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Yep, that's the name of the game. You started earlier about these limits. These limits are kind of soft limits, even for consumer items. There was a time I was looking up manufacturers of knife sharpening systems, and one of the most recommended, the number one was a Russian model, and you could buy them easily. They had an American distributor. I'm sure they kind of sent them to some third party, and that third party sent them to the American distributor, and so they kind of skated away from those limitations. A lot of these limitations are not that difficult to get around, especially the small, you know, the small size ones. Big size ones that require an oil tanker, it's kind of difficult to hide oil tankers. But, you know, small packages that get shipped to God knows Bulgaria, then from Bulgaria to America, you know, no one knows where they came from, and unfortunately not enough people care.
Interesting. Okay, the second subject, I'm not sure. If you want to handle it, please do so. If not, then I do it. It's up to you. What is Colton and why it is important to ham radio products too? Dr. Roy.
Yeah, Colton is a mineral. It's a mineral deposit. It's how tantalum is mined for the most part. Tantalum is an interesting metal, and it makes tantalum capacitors. Tantalum capacitors are electrolytes, electrolytics. They could be dry electrolytics or wet electrolytics. They could be bipolar. And so you wouldn't have to worry about which end to wire up. But their claim to fame is that they're very small, compact, and that they're very stable. Electrolytic capacitors will drift their capacitance according to temperature, whereas tantalum capacitors are much more stable temperature-wise.
Yes, then we have a problem. In 2008, 20% of tantalum that was, we had approximately 71% of the global tantalum supply, and in 2008 there was newly mined 20%. Then we had some from the mine recycling, and we had a slug in the inventory. Tantalum materials are mined in Democratic Republic of Congo, Colombia, Rwanda, Australia, Brazil, China, Ethiopia, Mozambique, and Kenya. And we are facing dramatic change in delivery of the material just because the rebel in Congo moved in Rwanda, and Rwanda was like a small, at least how I understood it, thief that was smuggling all of that mineral from Congo, ladies and gentlemen. And Russia has a problem too, not only United Europe, whole Europe and USA. Russia smuggles about 150 tons of it from Rwanda, and Rwanda doesn't have it, so Rwanda steals it from they use Uganda too, from Congo, Republic of Congo. And they belong to the group of calciterites, the oxide mineral SNO2. You want to explain that, Dr. Roy?
Well, you know, I don't think we really have to go into geology and such tonight. It's sufficient to say that, there's a general problem with the distribution of rare earth metals. And modern technology tends to require a significant amount of them. And that's going to be the big impact in the foreseeable future, is that there's only certain places that have them. And the tendency, again, for human beings is to be rather greedy. So they'll limit sales to raise the price so that they make more profit. And, tantalum is part of it. Some of the ingredients of our own beloved lithium batteries are made that way out of rare earth metals and limited resource. So that's one of the many reasons why everyone's getting angry with each other and threatening to invade each other and taking over mines and such. So it's one of the many fears in the modern world here.
Okay, one of the reasons why Donald Trump wants to buy Iceland, Greenland.
Yeah, that's the story that I heard, that he thinks that it has a lot of rare earth metals and he thinks America should own it. We'll see how all that stuff works out. And as I mentioned, Sam, the political net begins after midnight.
Political is a matter of public record.
Yeah, I realize that. I realize that, Sam. I'm just trying to be humorous. I'm sorry if I'm not funny.
Well, okay.
So, in here we have in the United States players listed by United Nations as who's gonna suffer from that, immediately suffer. Cabot Corporation, Boston, Massachusetts, OM Group, Cleveland, Ohio, AVX, Myrtle Beach, Eagle Wings Resources in Ohio, Trinitech International, Ohio, Kemet Electronics Corporation, Venice. Okay, so and then we have Belgium, Germany, China, and then worldwide we have a Nokia, Motorola, Compaq, Alcatel, Dell, well, Hewlett Packard is renamed, IBM, Lucent Technology, Ericsson, and Sony. But for us, the important is that we're going to have a problem with laptop computers, cell phones, jet engines, rackets, cutting coals, camera lenses, x-ray films, inkjet printers, hearing guides, peacemakers, airbags protection system, ignition and motor control modules, GPS, ABS systems, automobiles, game consoles, PlayStation, Xbox, and Nintendo, video cameras, digital still cameras, sputtering targets, chemical processing equipment, cathodic processing system for steel structures such as bridges, water tanks, prosthetic devices for humans, structure clips, corrosion resistance fasteners, screws, nuts, bolts, high temperature furnace parts, high temperature alloys, and it's a critical situation to the United States, United Kingdom, European Union, just because of conflict in Congo and Rwanda. And, of course, with the participation of Uganda government. So we don't have a political net. I just wanted to read that list so Americans know what we are facing, Dr. Ray.
Yeah, I mean, resources have always been problematic. The positive thing is we don't know where all the minerals are until the end of the game. So, you know, if you would have asked an expert in fossil fuels a century ago, how long before we run out of the fuel that's known to exist, he would have told you before now. The benefit of scarcity is it raises the price of items. The rising of the price of items increases the motivation of people to invest in locating other sources for the material. And who knows? Maybe next year we'll find some big supply of tantalum buried in a mountaintop in a less politically erratic place. So you know, I mean, unfortunately, resources are not infinite. I mentioned this way back when we were talking about artificial intelligence and this nonsense that a super intelligent computer is going to make resources unlimited. That isn't how resources work. So we'll see what happens. We won't know that we've reached the bottom until we're there, and we're not there. So a lot of scary possibilities, but we'll see what the future brings. Hopefully the economic forces of capitalism will find a get around for this as well, at least in the short term. Eventually we'll kind of burn up the damn planet, unfortunately, but you know, we don't really care about that because that's a long time in the future, and we're not there yet. So we'll see how things work out. Hopefully for the better. If not, it's like the weather. There's not much you can really ultimately do about it.
Okay, I believe a few topics I'm going to leave for the next, because right now we have a little time left. So another one is, why do high-frequency radio signals have shorter range? And I'm going to read the statement. The longer the wavelength, the further the signal can penetrate through solid objects or liquids such as seawater. The Navy uses VLF, ULF radio frequency for communication, targeting, search, and rescue navigation, and some other uses. Ham radio, I'm not going to go further because the next article is Naval Postgraduate School, but let me go back to the question. Why do high-frequency radio signals have shorter range? Is anybody from the audience who wants to take a stand? Hey, Dr. Ray.
Yeah, we answered that a couple of weeks ago. It's called free space losses. It's a very well-known concept, and it happens in outer space where there's absolutely nothing interacting with the electromagnetic waves. So at the very basic reason, it's free space loss. There are other attenuating causes that kind of add up on top of it, but fundamentally, frequency-dependent attenuation is free space or free path space loss. That's it.
Yeah, I have a whole list of whatever questions there, but we have a limited time. So low frequency do not take more power. So if we ask the question why low frequency stations require the incredible amount of power, we're talking about VLF. So the answer would be, the low frequency transmitters do not take more power. However, many low frequency systems are based on high power principles. It doesn't hurt to have a few watts more, but not the megawatts more. So the question to you, Dr. Roy, is why do we use megawatts of power on those very low frequency spectrum?
Well, it's kind of a dated question, because if you asked the question about 15, 20 years ago, people would just start discussing submarines and all kinds of fun stuff that we've talked about on the technical net. It's less of a case that the Navy is using ultra-low frequencies, which is why they kind of released, to some degree, experimentation for hams of ultra-low frequency. The problem with ultra-low frequency is that mechanical building of radiating antennas are inherently lead to inefficient radiators simply because of the limitations. You're scaling it up to a ridiculous size, so you have to kind of scale it down, and the scaling down causes inefficiencies. But the more power you push through it, the more the signal can reach distances. And the problem that we also talked about is symbol rate is terrible for ultra-low frequency, because as you bring the frequency of the carrier down, you have to kind of bring the